Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the History of Fresh Produce, the podcast series that explores the fascinating and often overlooked history of fresh fruits and vegetables. Here are your hosts, Patrick Kelly and John Parr.
King Cundit's ambassadors proceeded on their way back and had a favorable breeze across the sea. They came to King Cundit and told him the result of their errand and King Olaf's last words. King Cundit replies, "King Olaf guesses wrong if he thinks I shall eat up all the kale in England, for I will let him see that there is something else than kale under my ribs, and cold kale it shall be for him." Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the History of Fresh Produce. And that, Patrick, was a passage from one of the first Viking sagas written, the Saga of Olaf Haraldsson. And as you can probably guess at this point, today we are talking about Vikings.
I'm ready. I'm ready to talk about Vikings. You know, man, if I had my beard for this episode, I'm just saying, you know, it would have been perfect. You know, when I was in the Dominican Republic, what was it last year? I was actually able to braid my mustache for the first time because it was so long. And
that's right.
You know, there's one thing I didn't do when I had my beard down to the middle of my chest was actually try to like braid it. And I always wish I did, you know, it made me feel more Viking if I had my beard braided, man. I don't know why, but
it's just part of that visual scene that we have of Viking.
Right? Like that's exactly what we, you know, feel, you know, and today we're going to talk a little bit about some meals and fresh produce and everything involved within the Viking world. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely. It's going to be a completely new perspective on Vikings, I think, for most people that haven't really learned much about Viking history before. And
true that.
Speaking of beards, we have a special guest today who does have an epic beard, I think, tying into the Viking thing. And he's actually not only that, but a leading expert on Viking age food. He's culinary archaeologist and author Daniel Serra, all the way from Sweden. And welcome to the show, Daniel.
Thank you. Hello.
Now that's right a there. Beard, my friend. That is a beard. I got to pull up a picture as we keep going. But, you know, Daniel, I grew a beard for just about 6 years. And really it came from I couldn't grow any facial hair until I was like 26 years old. So when I finally was able to grow it, I was like, I'm not going to get rid of it. What if it doesn't grow back? So, and now it's like, this is like 2 weeks and it just happens overnight. But I think it comes from my Irish heritage. You know, I got this orangish red beard, mustard colored beard, man, but yours is epic for sure.
Thank you.
Well, beards aside, we're going to dive into Viking world here. And I think a great place to start is to really paint a picture for our listeners on who exactly the Vikings were. Because I think a lot of us have a very specific Hollywood picture in our minds of who the Vikings were and what they looked like. But I think there's a whole other side of the story to who the Vikings were. So can you explain to us who the Vikings were and what that looked like?
To start with, the word Viking, I mean, it's sort of connected to our Hollywood image, that is, the word Viking has to do with being a pirate, being a plunderer, whereas most people in northern Scandinavia, the Norse people, were farmers, were traders, so that will be just a small percentage of the people in Scandinavia being Viking. Talking about the Vikings as a sort of a whole concept, it's a bit wrong. So you would have a difference between the people go Viking is when you go raiding. But that would be referred to other people. You don't have to be from Scandinavia to be a Viking. Rather, people in Scandinavia, the North Scandinavian people, they were mainly farmers. They were mainly domesticated. And it sort of shows in their culture as well that they sort of orient themselves around things that grows on a farm.
Interesting. So Viking is more of a verb. So technically Viking today, technically.
Yeah. If you go pirating, yes.
Check. All right, I'm one in already, John. I don't know about you, but
yeah. So there you go.
So when people say that they have an ancestry like 12% Viking, that can't be true because you can't really tell someone's profession from the DNA.
No, so that's interesting. So how would people that we think of as Vikings identify themselves during that period? What would they be calling themselves?
I think it would be more of, that's difficult to say, but I think it would be more like people of this either tribe or family. It's difficult to say. I can't really give you, because it's mainly when you have names, it's from Roman or external sources, and that not, might not even be what they call themselves.
Right. So they weren't necessarily thinking of themselves as like a group or a culture of people. It was like you kind of painted here as more of a tribal, individualistic societies that I guess on a, eventually kind of banded together into kingdoms.
Yes, and it also depends on when, at what time period you would look at, even if it's in the beginning of the Viking Age. We talk about Viking Age, that's what we do in even in archaeology, because it's sort of so from the 9th century to the 11th century. But so beginning, you would have the more tribal, you will have kingdoms growing quite perhaps as early as the 10th century, 9th century. But yes, so it's difficult. And if you're from Iceland, you would probably identify as being from Iceland, but you will also identify from your home farm. It's complex, just like today.
Yeah, yeah, definitely sounds similar to today. So we know what Viking means now. We know, you just touched on the period, about late 9th century to 11th century. So where were people Viking? And where was this all happening from a geography standpoint?
Well, so you would have the people coming from Scandinavia, would be Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Iceland as well. And to some extent, you have settlement in northern Poland as well. But yes, Baltic areas, to some extent, there's lots of interconnection between the Baltic areas. But say Scandinavia, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Iceland would be the main parts where you would have coming from. And then raids, trades would be northern Europe, England for Norwegian and Danish people, and from Swedish areas, people would go more eastwards. You would have the connection to the sort of going down the rivers in Russia.
Yeah, I think that's another thing that we don't necessarily always think of the Vikings being that large of a footprint, because they did, like you say, they ended up going pretty far south. I mean, they were in what we know as Turkey today, the Byzantine Empire, the Roman Empire. They were trading all the way down there and bringing a lot of these things back home to Scandinavia.
A lot of trading. Working in Constantinople as guards, trading across, along the rivers in Russia. And you also have this sort of connection between people from Scandinavia and the emerging Russian countries. Rus Viking is also another word, explore.
You know, Daniel, as I keep looking and, you know, researching, you know, Viking cuisine, you know, that's one of the questions, you know, we had popped up is, you know, how has research uncovered the Viking cuisine? Like, you know, you would just think about it. I mean, was there delicacies for Vikings? What did they eat on a normal basis, right? So, you know, how has research uncovered it in the last so many, you know, decades?
I mean, it's a difficult subject because there's no written sources. There's no written evidence from the Viking Age. So there's no written cookbooks. There's no, I mean, you have runic stones, you have the sagas written later, but you have no cookbooks. You have no manuscripts saying what you have in the goblets. Like you would have later on, the couples, the larders. Only go from archaeology. So what I do when I work with this, I call myself a culinary archaeologist, which means I try to reconstruct the food from the Viking Age, among others, and I base it on archaeology. So I look first at what finds do we have, what kind of ingredients do we have for this cuisine, what kind of cooking methods. That would give us a part, but that would be like emptying out the cookbook and just look at the details. Doesn't really give you any idea of what they actually ate. Then I would have to look at the sagas, sort of sift through them and see what can be said old oral tradition. What can we say about, what can we find in later literature that can sort of apply to the Viking Age? What can we find on continental, like Anglo-Saxon medical sources? What can that tell us about how they used cooking equipment? So we have to piece together, and I do this through archaeology and through experimental archaeology. So I start with the finds, I try them out in time-appropriate equipment and see, well, how does it work together? How does it work to cook stuff stone, soapstone vessel? And the next part will be to look at the written sources, get some ideas. Well, porridge was important. That would be an everyday food. You would have things like kale, turnips, and fish would also be important as everyday food. Then you also have to look into, as you said, delicacies. Yes, you can find some in the sagas, and in some places, it's so important that you think, well, this is might actually represent original part of this oral tradition. Like in the saga of Sigurd the Dragon Slayer, beginning of that saga, he's slaughtering the dragon and he takes out the heart roast it and eat it and becomes immortal and after a long time, and then he kills his uncle and all this stuff. But yes, it starts off, and that's actually depicted in a runic stone in Sweden, the killing of the dragon and the roasting of the heart. Then right. The saga, this tragedy, this is sort of long, epic tragedy. So it ends on a note, so it's sort of foreshadowing the end of it as well. So in the end, the last part of this epic, the gold has traveled through many people together with the curse. And in the last part, the King Atle is served a heart tasting of honey. He's being served that by his wife, and she's angry at him. She wants revenge because her brothers and father and family. So she wants revenge. She carries his children, and then he serves this feast with honeyed hearts. Then when he's eaten, he says, well, of course, this is not the heart of the lamb. This is the heart of your kids. So your children's heart.
Wow.
So morbid, but the thing here is a little bit, yes. I haven't tried it with actual children yet, just lamb's heart. But still, you get the idea of honey. It's spit roasted, a very exclusive part of the animal. Wow. So you get this kind of delicacy idea from this. And this is so important in the storytelling that I would say this is most likely part of the oral tradition.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, and for most of the listeners out there, right, they probably heard saga and they're probably thinking to themselves, like, what is saga? What is, you know, the Viking saga? You know, they might think of like it being, you know, generation after generation. So explain what a saga is, as most people probably wouldn't know what that means when it comes to food or a culture.
Usually the oral traditions, but it's written down. It's in the Viking sense, it's you either have these sort of family stories. It is storytelling, often quite a lot of death, and almost the same as in the Greek tragedies as well. You have fate being an important part of this, but it's also the descriptions as you read the saga of Olaf Tryggvason. It's the storytelling about how things happened in this story. So I can't give a good description of saga or sort of definition of saga because, I mean, today we associate it with the storytelling for
right, like the Star Wars saga, right?
Star Wars saga, yes.
Yeah, I'm trying to give everybody just a frame of reference, right, John? Just something that they can look at when they think of the Viking saga. I mean, yeah, it's a part of storytelling.
Closest thing in popular culture, you would be, of course, Lord of the Rings.
Right, yeah.
Even better reference.
Because he was very much inspired by the Viking sagas. You have this epic, tragic part. You have the violent part. You have the mythical part in it. And it's a story. It's traveling, something happening. You have the hero's journey. I would say that the Viking sagas have quite often anti-heroes as the protagonist.
Yeah, I got it.
So we know that, you know, like you just said, there's a lot of morbid and violence in these Viking sagas and perceived culture of the Vikings. But from what I understand, there's also, for majority of the people that we classify as Vikings, there was a whole other side to that society and culture. And a big piece of that was farming and the farmsteads of the Viking people. So tell us a little bit about what that looked like. How did the Viking society operate? What was the role of farmers and farming in these societies?
Well, I would say that farming was sort of central. And again, it's not Viking, it's Norse people, because if you're farming, you weren't necessarily raiding. But yes, that's society and culture would have been quite focused along farming. It would be household farms. It's not the manorial farms of later times, but they were ingrained in the idea that they were farmers. If you look at the food remains, most of them seem to be concentrated about finds from the actual farm. It's not very much of wild animals, wild growing vegetables. And it goes that far. When they go to Greenland, you have the settlement in Greenland. And this is later on as well, because it's people remain settled in Greenland up to the 13th century. But they were so intent on being farmers that they really had to cattle. They had cattle there, but the cattle didn't thrive. Greenland was not a good place for keeping cattle. They shrunk in time, so they became smaller and yielding of meat. But still, they kept on identifying themselves as farmers, and this was important. So I would say farming culture was quite important. Fish and farms, you would grow what you needed. There's also finds and evidence of people growing not only out in the fields, but you would have herb gardens or leek gardens as well. So you would grow both main produce, like grains, which would be very important for making beer and making porridge. And you would also make grow turnips, herbs, allium.
Yeah, so you had vegetable garden. I think there's even some orchards, right? Some of these farmsteads has small orchards.
That comes more later, but you find berries and you find fruits. But actual orchards would be a bit more common later, I would say.
Well, yeah, so a little rarer at the beginning. So like you pointed out correctly, because I'm falling into the trap of modern culture calling everything Vikings. Like I said, these were farmers. These were Norsemen that were not Viking. They were at their farmsteads. This got me thinking, because farming culture was so important to the Norse people, and a lot of these people obviously originating in the Scandinavian region, did there come a point where there's just so little land to be had there that might have led to people to Viking and expand and raid and take over these other lands, fertile lands maybe in England and such?
Theory. And that's, you have several things happening at the same time, I think. You would have the sort of strive for more land. People were colonizing in Scandinavia as well, so they were going to less fertile lands as well. So you can see that. You will have people... you would, same time at like 9th century, you would have political changes as well. So like people in Norway would be going, so one of the main reasons for people going to Iceland would be political strife. People fighting for dominance and the king becoming a king, meaning that people are getting away from that and people settled to Iceland for that reason. And it could also be with sort of inheritance laws that you pass it on to the oldest son. The farm, and then it will not be. There are several reasons why people would go raiding. I don't think we can find just the one reason for that.
Sure. So it sounds like, you know, fertile lands, agriculture would have been one of the potential reasons, in addition to, you know, obviously for wealth and other physical manifestations of wealth, in addition to agriculture and just cultural expansion, I suppose.
I think it's great, man. Daniel, what I always think about is, I love your reference of Lord of the Rings, because obviously there's a lot of like the Viking culture, I think, in there. And the same thing, you know, if you think of even the story of like Beowulf and, you know, even some of the stories that are on, you know, today that talk about the Vikings, it's like, you know, when I think of, you know, Viking farmers, I don't think of the men farming. I think of the men fighting, and then you've got these like beasts of women and children that are actually making the food and on the farms. And I think it was just a different way of actually thinking about it, and about the, you know, the different type of crops there were, the significance in some of these crops. Like if you look at the history of fresh produce, I mean, there were things like potatoes, right, that were staple items, you know, in meals, right? John, like just thinking about, you know, the Viking farmers, what were the items that were here, right? What can be here, right? So, you know, I always say, like, before we get into it though, right, Daniel, it's like, well, we're gonna take a quick break, and then we're gonna get right into like the Vikings and produce and really talk about, you know, the different crops, what was grown, what was traded, what was cultivated for personal use. What do you say, John, take a quick break and then get back to talking about Vikings and produce?
That sounds good to me. I'm ready to hear what these folks were eating.
JGLC, the place to be, a third-generation, family-owned and operated asset-based company. Throughout their 60 years in business, integrity, reliability, and loyalty to their customers has remained their top priority. JGLC guarantees 24/7 communication with your personal logistics coordinator. They offer competitive pricing without sacrificing services. They operate throughout the United States and Canada. JGLC's customers count on them for dependability and dedication carried out on every order, every time. 60 years of service for all your trucking needs. Visit them at jglc.com for your custom quote.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the History of Fresh Produce. We are journeying through the Viking Age with our special guest, Daniel Serra. And before we cut to break, we learned basically the landscape of the Viking era and the significance of farming in that era. And now we're going to dive into what these folks were growing, why they were growing it, and the significance within their culture. So
I'm ready for that. Because like I said, as we do the history of a lot of different just fresh produce items, and then obviously learning about the lands of Hawaii and learning what each demographics and culture, John, brought, you know what I mean? I think it's interesting to find out what Viking staple items were. What were they growing, right? The demographics, the culture, the time period. So let's get Daniel back on.
So Daniel, I know obviously we, again, I'm sure meat, fish, dairy were all incorporated into the Viking diet. But because this is the history of fresh produce, we're not going to necessarily dive into the details of that. But produce also had a role. You know, obviously there was quite a selection of product that were grown on these gardens, on these farmsteads. But we want to look at some of the more significant ones or the ones that are more familiar to people today. And I know when I was reading your book, which we haven't even mentioned yet, but you have a fabulous book called An Early Meal, A Viking Age Cookbook and Culinary Odyssey, which I have right here. And we'll put this in the show notes, but in there you touch on a number of products, and one that I remember reading about was wild celery, and that had an important role in the foodstuffs of the Norse people. So can you tell us a little bit more about this crop and its significance within the cuisine?
Well, we don't really know how it was used, but it is definitely important. It's used in, it often appears in sagas and in laws. There are some laws against people stealing angelica and wild celery from your herb garden. There's one saga in which someone hands over a stalk of as a betrothal gift, which means that it has some importance. Exactly how it was cooked, I usually use it as for taste, almost like celery. You use it in the beginning of a dish, but it's, you can't really tell from the finds or from the sagas how it was used. We have to sort of imply through all the evidence and try to put it together.
Yeah, it is funny because you mentioned the sagas again. And I do recall when I was reading this, like you said, there was some laws stating there. If one man goes in another man's garden, our Angelica garden, and then he is lawless. So that was yes. That was a funny one.
It had some more, I think it had more importance in it has a good higher status than, for instance, allium, which was also an important crop that you were, or the produce you were growing. Allium and the turnips, but Angelica, it had some, and also you wouldn't, in a way, you probably wouldn't give someone a stalk of leek stalk as a betrothal gift, but Angelica seemed to be appropriate.
Oh, interesting. So Angelica was more of a status crop as well. It had an associated status to it.
I think so.
So some things don't change. It's all about what is readily available and how it is associated within society. And then I know there's another saga around this. It was something with bringing a stock to a queen and she wasn't really impressed with it and thought it was kind of a pitiful gift. And then,
then there's also someone who's sort of his life is saved by it, grabbing onto his angelica, branch of angelica or plant of angelica when he was falling over a cliff. So yes, it's multi-layered.
Yeah. Okay. So interesting. So the angelica was used more as a spice, like you said, almost like a spice or a way to flavor food.
Yeah, I would say so. That would be my guess, at least.
Daniel, as we keep moving along too, I mean, looking at the next crop, I obviously notice this. Two of these go hand in hand. It's garlic and onion. You know, Vikings also had access to, you know, the various spices, as I know we've talked about. And, you know, people, I would say, probably ate the leaves, not the bowl. I want to talk about that a little bit. Talk to me about the onions and the garlic, I would say, category when this was brought into the world, you know, for Vikings.
Well, it's allium seems to be important. You have some of the first runic inscriptions where it would be sort of allium and ale. So there's a bit of difficulty with linguistics here because we say lurk for everything would be, and some people translate it with onion, but it's lurk is the same name as leek. But yeah, so allium and ale, that's one of the first runic inscriptions we have. So we don't really know what kind it was. We have some finds. We have one find from Denmark, which is in a small bronze container with linen, and it's probably some beech leek, Scropidosium, something, Allium Scropidosium, I think it is. You have to check the Latin names because I can't really pronounce them. And then you have a find from Öland, which is also part of a morbid story. It's a fortress that was burnt down. People were burnt inside the house. It's kind of a massacre. But in this burnt fortress, they found small pieces of allium, most likely a potato onion, which sort of is a distant relation to Charlotten. And then you have descriptions in the sagas. The two descriptions are, in one place, it's described as being tall and beer-like and having quite a fragrant smell or odor, It smells a lot. In the, I think it's a saga about Olaf Tryggvason, it is used as a triage. So you would tell the people who have been, this is about this, I think the Battle of Stiklestad, and they visit the sort of herbalists taking care of the wounded people. And they are giving a triage of grass, which could be herbs, allium, and giving this to the people to eat. And if, and then the woman who's in charge of this goes around and smell people. And if they have a cut to the stomach and they, and you can smell this garlicky smell, then you put them on the side and you can tell.
I think that's cool. You know, just talking about, obviously going back, the same things that we kind of, you know, feel today too, the smell, the taste, you know, and you brought up the garlics, you know, garlic seeds from the Viking period, you know, have been found in York, England, and may have also been, you know, cultivated in Norway. So there are some things out there, right? And onions were actually used for diagnosing illnesses in the early ages. So they made onion soup and fed it to individuals, you know, who had been, you know, stabbed in the stomach with a sword, right? They, if the wound smelled oniony, I love that, that was a sign that the person, you know, probably couldn't be saved, right? A sour or kind of a pungent smell. Smell meant that there was a hole in the intestines. It was the end of the run and a way of sorting the injured out too. So ways that, you know, fruits and vegetables, or in this case, onions, were used in various items, right? From, you know, soups to help you get better, to knowing that if this guy smells like an onion, we might be losing him, right? So yeah, it's funny how we use that, right?
Yeah. And actually, when it comes to garlic, though we haven't got any finds from it here, the name suggests it, gives some connection. Garlic, I think, it means spear leek. And we have this description of it being spear-shaped onion that's sort of described in the saga. So that might be a connection. I've been using Ramsons because it has a spear shape and it also has this fragrant smell. So yeah, so that's been important.
Yeah, it's onion was definitely a funny one to me with the whole onion soup strategy for sorting the illness. I thought that was pretty unique.
Has an idea of being a preservative, as sort of
right,
helping you. And I'm not sure if there's another saga that's sort of a bit rude. It's about the Völse.
Okay.
So it's a description. Also, I think it's from the time when Norway was Christian, and it's supposed to be a saga that might be mocking the pagans. So one of the men of the king, Christian, is out in the middle of nowhere riding out, and it's stormy night, so he goes to the farm, asks to be lodged there. And of course, that's part of the culture, so yes, he will be lodged. And they serve dinner.
Yeah.
And for dinner, this pagan family brings out a mummified horse penis, wrapped in linen and allium, gives an idea of the sort of, and then everyone reads a sort of like a poem to this horse penis. Of course, they have some theme that fits with it. Yeah. And then it comes to the king's man, and he says, no, throws it in the fire, says, no, we're Christian now, we can't do this. Some fighting. But yeah, but the idea that onions might help preserving things seems to be present as well.
Interesting. Well, that was definitely not a direction I thought was going to go on this show. Who would have thought we would have heard about horse penises on the History of Fresh Produce? But interesting. Yep.
Just saying.
Hey, we like to keep things interesting here. On the subject of twigs and berries, let's move to berries. And Vikings also had berries integrated into their culinary elements, right?
We find them, but we do find them, but it seems to be not everywhere to find it. It's like lingonberries, bilberries, cloudberries, crowberries. One use, and this is special up in Lofoten, most of the berries are found in the Threlse area. It's found in the Stolz, there's large longhouse. In the Lofoten, we have the biggest longhouse found. It's 90 meters, so half of it is for animals, keeping animals, and other half is for living people, for people living in. But in the furthest part of this, where you kept cattle and animals, you find a small collection of berries or seeds from berries. And I guess that that was used to make alcohol for the Thralls, because they couldn't get hold of it anywhere else. And you can find some ideas in between the lines that it might be not, if you go out gathering, would it be nuts? Would it be berries? Would it be something else? That might not have a very high status. So gathering, as opposed to growing things, is seen as a lesser status thing. So you would have the thralls while herding the animals, picking berries, and then putting it into the dung in a container to ferment it. So I would say that they, in that case, they would have used the berries for making berry wine.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So they weren't, we have to assume, obviously, if these were being foraged, every now and then they probably would take a few to munch on fresh. But the primary purpose for the berries was to make alcoholic beverages or beverages in general.
We don't really know that, but it could be for other things. You can store things in berries, perhaps. Mm-hmm. I think in Saxon Grammatica, it's talk about the strange people in the south using berries for for the food. So he doesn't really approve of this new thing, but... So you could use it for the food as well. So it depends on the context, I would say. So you would probably use it for other things than just wine, but alcohol, yeah, that would be a good reason, good way of using it.
Yeah.
We know from later periods, traditional use of lingonberries could be to store things like even meat in it, because it's very strong preservative properties.
Yeah, I would not imagine berries being used as a preservative. That's pretty wild.
Yeah, I would say that's an interesting topic at all. I mean, just thinking about berries. But what about apples? I mean, apples can be used for some pretty different things. I know that when we got in talking about apples, John, obviously orchards, with having orchards, there's got to be some type of skill involved, right? Labor. Again, the same thing included apples, pears, cherries. Apples appeared, you know, I'll go ahead and look at some of the notes that I have. But, you know, apples appear to be very important to Viking culture. As, you know, excavated burial sites would see preserved apples among the burial sites. Nordic mythology, you know, the goddesses, you know, Idun's apples kept the gods eternally young. Heck, what's that saying? An apple a day keep the doctor away. You know, I'm still trying to figure that statement out because I'm still going to the doctor all the time. But as many apples as I eat. But when you think of apples too, I mean, I always think of, you know, ale, right? Because you can make liquor, alcohol out of, you know, apples. So cider comes into play where apples were used, you know, fermented, but they could also, they're used, I would say, for consumption after fermented and no help for humans at all. But, you know, talk about that. You know, where did apples play a big culture, you know, in the Viking world as well?
Well, as you say, it's found in some burials. Well, one of the most prominent burials from the Viking age would be the Oseberg ship. And there's a bucket of apples there. Exactly the use, again, it's difficult to say, but you find it in graves, and you have it in the Idun's apples, the sort of the apples for keeping the gods immortal. So it might have also, again, have some preservative ideas. And the apples used would have been quite sour, would be crab apples. Sweet apples we have today is probably not connected to the apples from the Viking age. So it's more sour, acidic, and that could be used for some kind of preserving. That's also difficult to say. There's nothing really written about except for the Idun's apples. I would say they most likely are processed in some way. They don't seem to eat them raw, but that's more based on later inference. So in medieval period, you probably wouldn't eat that much, but you would probably make alcohol. Yeah, that would be most likely way of using apples, making some kind of cider. So yeah, I would find that probable. In later periods, in the 12th, 13th century, you would have people describing having must, which is in that time would be like cider, would be processed apples.
Yeah, well, what's actually interesting too, of course, is that cider was, Normandy is obviously known for being like one of the apple cider capitals. And look, you got Rollo the Walker that came down there and settled. So there are some interesting connections that could substantiate all the thoughts we have around apple cider and that cuisine in that culture. So it's definitely interesting ties that can substantiate that. But what about the last one that we have on our list here, which I think is probably also a big one. You've touched on it already a few times when talking about the farms, was turnips. So what did turnips have? Because I know obviously just inherently what we use them for today, you know, they're good for flavoring as well as in like soups, store them for quite a long time. I imagine they probably played a pretty significant role in similar ways that they do today, that you can keep them for a long time and they're good for adding flavor and
I would say that, yes, as you say, they're good for keeping a long time. You can pick them in autumn, you can keep them a winter. It's described later on that you put them in sand and you can keep them a long time that way. And you'll probably eat them as part of a meal, or you could, one of the simplest dishes I do from inspired from the Viking Age would be just roasting turnips in the fire. Chuck them into the fire, cook until they're all black on the outside, peel off the outer layer and eat them with some butter. That's an excellent meal. What we know from growing is that in Uppåkra, which is a settlement which predates the Viking Age a bit, but also goes into the Viking Age, south of, or just outside of Lund in the south of Sweden, there's a small patch of land where people have been growing turnips just outside one of the longhouses. Yes, turnips seem to have had an important everyday role in society. And I think I will need to add another produce, which I've been touching on, but barley. Barley would have been one of the most,
barley,
also the most important part, for two reasons: beer and porridges. And porridges in the Viking Age would have been savory rather than sweet.
Yeah,
very interesting. Yeah.
But barley, like if you look at almost every Viking Age settlement, if you look at archaeological record, like 70% of all grains would be barley. 70 to 80%.
That's amazing. What about the legacy? You know, think about, you know, who's living this legacy. And like you said earlier too, I mean, the research, you know, it wasn't like they just, it was in a book and said, here's everything we've done over the last so many years. Obviously, it's taken time to gather a lot of this, you know, information, what was cooked, you know, what was slaughtered, what was grown, you know, but what is the legacy of Viking cuisine? You know, how is it trying to be preserved, or you know, are people still, you know, trying to make this a part of the culture and history of, you know, Vikings?
Difficult to say, actually, because it's, I don't think there's, well, we have had quite a lot of cultural, culinary changes. This is 1,000 years ago, so of course things have changed. So if you have any legacies sort of surviving from that time, I would say could be, well, not really touching on what we're doing here, but like dairy products, that could be something. We have soured milk, so the importance of dairy products could be one part. Importance of beer, of course. That's also, we've been beer drinkers up here. So I would say that that could be something you can say is a legacy of the Viking Age. Drinking beer for Christmas, that would be like one culinary tradition that goes back to the Viking Age.
Right.
But we don't really have any surviving legacies. So if people are trying to recreate, if you look at into sort of modern, the sort of future of food, people are trying to go back to some of the grain, sort of some of the vegetables being used in the Viking Age and medieval period, like great peas and broad beans. They are, I had some discussion with people researching the food of the future, and they were talking about going back to these grain, sort of legumes that grows very well in Scandinavia, handles the climate, don't use too much of the environment. So yeah, we should be going back to broad beans and the great peas.
Very much looking back to the past for the future of how to be a little more connected to our local products, our local crops, and incorporating that more into our diet. So that is an interesting legacy. I think we see that a lot in today's, in our industry in particular, fresh produce. We're trying to look, I think, more to past practices and histories and carrying that into today as an answer to a lot of our challenges.
Yes, and also I think what something you can look back at the Viking Age or even earlier is the balance between meat and vegetables, which is, I mean, today we eat quite a lot more meat than we did back in the Viking Age, despite all the pictures you get from films, etc. I would say meat would have been a less prominent part of the meal than it is today.
So they were a lot healthier than us in terms of their balanced diet. So we have...
Yes and no. I mean, of course, you have... If you have...
Maybe.
Maybe. I mean, you have a primitive farming culture, so you are reliant on what... if you have drought, if you have a bad year, then you would probably only eat one thing. But yes, in the sense of your balance between meat and vegetables, yes, that would probably be a bit more balanced.
Okay. So we have to eat more like Vikings.
In that sense, I think, I will not say anything about health issues, but yes, we'll probably for environment's sake, I think we should eat more like the Viking Age in medieval period, sort of have meat being just a part of the meal rather than the sort of center.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to wrap up that conversation. So everybody who heard it, we have to eat more like the Vikings, more balanced, less meat, more vegetables, fruits. Can't thank you enough, Daniel, for joining us today. It's been a fascinating overview of the Viking cuisine. I know I learned a lot. I'm sure Patrick feels the same way. And again, we want to remind all our listeners about your book. It's an early meal, a Viking Age cookbook, a culinary odyssey. So again, we've had a few of our guests like this on where they've written a fabulous book about not only the history of a specific period or culture, but it has recipes. So you can make these at home and really at least get a flavor. It might not be exactly, but a flavor of what this kind of food tasted like, in this case from the Viking era. So thank you again, Daniel. Yeah, I guess until next time, it's goodbye for me, John Papp.
Goodbye for me.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Daniel.